is 4:07 on the Central Coast. How are you? I'm Dave Congleton. Good to be with you. Thanks for tuning in. Hope you'll stick around. Straight ahead on this broadcast during the 5 o'clock hour, Mike Brown is the executive director of CoLab of San Luis Obispo County. All sorts of issues in front of the Board of Supervisors. We're here from Mike. We'll hear from you. And then we'll see where the 6 o'clock hour takes us. We're going to start off. Bruce Curtis is going to join us for the first part. I want to talk about this guy who's suing the county, a bicyclist suing the county, because he's riding by the airport and he claims he got blown off his bike by a jet engine. Actually, it's a little bit more serious than what the paper led us to believe. Anyway, that's where we're going this afternoon. It is the Dave Congleton Show, always your hometown radio talk show. Look who's here. The one, the only, travel writer extraordinaire, Mr. Tom Wilmer, celebrating 30 years in the biz. How are you, sir?
I'm good, Dave. How are you?
30 years.
Yeah, seems like a long time.
I got 2.5 years to catch up to you.
You'll get there.
I don't know. We'll see.
Yeah.
30 years.
I know. 1989.
Now, this is 30 years on KCBX?
Yeah, on air. I did a stint with KRML, Clint Eastwood's old station up in Carmel.
Oh, yeah,
yeah. I did on-air travel, digital media travel for them.
Did they have digital media back in 1989?
Well, no, that was only like 4 or 5 years ago.
Okay.
Yeah. So play Misty for me.
How long have you been doing travel writing?
Around the same time, maybe 35 years, something like that.
All right. So you were a travel writer for about 5 years.
When what happened, I was a ghostwriter for a New York Times syndicated travel columnist. And he'd send me to Monte Carlo, Africa, or whatever. And I went, wow, since I'm already on the ground, if the station bought me a recorder, I'd try a travel show. And I did, and still doing it.
But wait, back up. This guy hired you to ghostwrite pieces for him?
For the New York Times Syndicate. Yeah, it showed with his byline, his photo. But, you know, I got a trip to Africa, I got a trip to China, or whatever out of it.
Was this so that he could cover more ground?
Yeah, he was so busy, he didn't have time to do all the assignments. One time it was really funny. I'm in a sewer trench in Cambria on a construction job. He calls and he says, can you go to Monte Carlo for me tomorrow? And I'm going, whoa, how cool. He thinks I'm holding out. He goes, first class Air France. So I did.
And what was Monte Carlo like?
It was awesome. But the king, Prince Rainier's press attaché did not like me. I think she saw through that I was actually cowboy contractor, not the elite, and she just gave me grief, man, the whole time.
But I would think people would want to be nicer to travel writers. Look at all, you're giving them all this free publicity.
One would think, yeah. Most of the time, they are.
All right, but that was not a typical situation for you.
No, that was bizarre.
All right. I know it's not ready yet, but you're in the process of writing a new book?
Yeah, called The Imposter Syndrome, and it's a collection of stories of my travels and things I've done throughout my life. And it's interesting because I was one of the deadliest catch guys before they coined the term out of Kodiak. And I luckily...
Explain the term.
Working on big shrimp trawlers and, you know, king crabbers and whatnot in Alaska. It's a TV show called The Deadliest Catch.
Okay.
I was on a shrimp trawler out of Kodiak, not a king crabber. But nonetheless, I kept a journal and I'm glad I did because it was a bizarre adventure.
And?
Well, the skipper, he was an Irish boat called the Irish Rover. He looked like John Wayne with an Irish accent.
Yeah.
And he was mean and sadistic, but charming as you would not believe. He'd walk into a bar in Kodiak within 10 minutes, there'd be 20 fishermen sitting around listening to his stories. He was so charming that this young 19-year-old who was working at Bumblebee Cannery needed to get out of there to go home because his wife was going to have a kid. And he was just charmed by the skipper. And the skipper said, yeah, if you sign on with us, we're going to Seattle in a couple of weeks. You got a free ride home. And let me back up a bit. When you work in canneries in Kodiak and whatnot, they will send you up there and give you an air ticket, but they won't give you a return ticket for a half a year. So you have to stay.
You have to stay there.
Yeah, so this kid needed to come home early, so he couldn't afford to go home. And the poor guy, he signed on to our boat, and the minute we left Kodiak Harbor, got deathly seasick. And we were fishing in the winter time. And in the winter, it takes about a week to get a whole boatload of shrimp. And so the poor little guy is 7 days, seven nights on the high seas, just sick as a dog and worthless.
And were you enjoying the experience, not of the guy, but I mean, about being out on the boat?
Well, in general, you know, it was crazy. It was brutal conditions working on a deck on a boat at about freezing temperatures and 15-foot seas. If you said, $1 million, Tom, today to go do it for 2 weeks, I go, nah, you go.
Wow.
It is pretty brutal.
I can't imagine anybody doing that.
Well, that's why they hire the young and dumb. Yeah.
So did the guy make it home safe?
He did eventually, okay. Yeah. He was not a happy camper, though.
I'm just looking at the chapters in your book that you're writing. Look at this. Bad day in Morocco.
Oh, that was a real bad
Russian
day.
Border, Shanghai, meeting Santa Claus in Finnish Lapland, Santiago, Honduras customs, Finnish baseball. You've been all over the world.
Yeah.
Peace Corps volunteers in Micronesia. Wow.
Yeah.
How many countries have you been to?
I don't know. People ask me that. I've never written
you
them
keep
all
track?
Down. No.
When might we see this book?
Well, probably Perfect World, maybe middle of next year. Just guessing, because I plug away on it late at night after I'm done doing other stuff.
Well, yeah, because you're always traveling.
Right. And
you should hire a ghostwriter.
Yeah.
I hear that works.
It does. It gets you around the world.
I'm sorry, you were about to say?
Oh, because I do it. A lot of the chapters are done, you know, but they need to be redone and re-edited and worked on. And then once I'm a storyteller, but unlike you see these meetups and whatnot where they have storytelling events, I've never been to one of those. Although I was on the stage at the National Storytelling Center in Tennessee, but I was interviewing a storyteller. So all my storytelling happens with other journalists sitting around the campfire in Nicaragua or whatever. But I've never really gone on stage to do it. I just tell them as we travel.
Tom Woolmer is back on Hometown Radio. How can people hear your podcasts and follow your stories?
My podcast show is called Journeys of Discovery with Tom Woolmer. If you put that whole search term, whole phrase into Apple Podcasts or Stitcher.com, there's a podcast site called Player.fm in the United Kingdom. I'm on there. Probably about 10 other sites. That would be the easiest way. It's on the npr.org podcast directory under Journeys of Discovery with Tom Woolmer.
We'll come back and find out where Tom's been lately. I'm Dave Congleton. This is Hometown Radio on AM 920, FM 96.5, News Talk, KVEC. Glad to have you with us on Hometown Radio. You're listening to the Dave Congleton Show. We're spending the hour catching up with travel writer Tom Woolmer. The guy just travels the country and he travels the world. Now, you're just back from Wisconsin, and you're going back to Wisconsin.
Yeah, on the 19th.
I grew up living one state south of Wisconsin. I haven't been back there in years.
Cool.
What were you doing in Wisconsin?
On this trip, it was Door County Peninsula. If you look at the map of Wisconsin on the right-hand side, about midway up, you'll see a thumb that sticks out.
Yeah.
That's Door County, that entire thumb.
All right.
On the left side of Door County of that thumb is Green Bay and Lake Michigan on the right-hand side. And so we were exploring lighthouses throughout Green Bay.
Are there a lot of lighthouses up there?
There are, yeah. Okay. We went to 11 in 3 days, and we didn't get them all, yeah. Yeah. And they go back to 1830s. It's just fascinating to see these stone lighthouses that were built in the 1830s, 1860s, that are just beautiful architecture and functional lighthouses.
Now, even though I'm a Midwesterner, I have never heard of Washington Island.
Oh, my God. But Washington Island is really fascinating. It's right off the northern tip of Door County.
Okay.
And the only way you get there, well, they have an airstrip you can fly your own plane in, but they have a ferry service. And I went 2 winters ago in January, and to get out there, you go on an icebreaker ferry boat. So that was quite a journey.
Can you just wait till the summer?
Well, yeah, but I wanted to see. I wanted to go to the winter and see what that was like. All right. But interesting anecdote about Washington Island. A lot of Norwegian settlers there. But at one time in history, in early immigration days, it was the number one immigrant kind of community of Icelandic people. And there still is an Icelandic community there.
So they come from Iceland to Washington Island.
Yeah.
Well, it makes sense. It's an island.
Well, and it's so far north that
far north.
Very similar environment.
They must have felt right at home.
They did.
What's on Washington Island, Tom?
It's about 700 full-time residents throughout the winter and summer. Probably burgeons to 1,500-1,600 during the summertime, because many people have summer homes and cottages on the island. And there's, you know, there's a gas station and a grocery store and a school and whatnot. One of the draws in kind of the current tourism attraction of Washington Island are lavender farms. Many people come there, like I did, to go to the lighthouses. The far end of the island, there's another ferry boat that takes you to even more remote island where we had to hike a couple miles across the island to get to another lighthouse.
Yeah, look at it now. It's 7 miles northeast of the tip of the Door Peninsula. Year-round population of 708 people.
Oh, it's off by 8.
Wow.
Yeah, really beautiful place.
Yeah. And they have a lot of lighthouses on the island.
Well, they have one or two on Washington and then another. I think it's Block Island or something.
I've never been to Green Bay. Anything there?
Yeah.
Never been.
Yeah, it's beautiful. And a really interesting part of the history of Green Bay goes back to World War II. It was a major builder of military ships, PT boats and bigger. And they still build some military craft there. There was a high-end boat builder in Green Bay that made those mega luxury yachts for Dubai kings and whatnot, but they just got bought and moved overseas. But for years and years, they made like 200-foot-long yachts, just incredible things.
I guess the major draw of Green Bay would be the football team.
Green Bay, the town of Green Bay, Green Bay Packers, at the very bottom of Green Bay, is just a really cool town. And the Green Bay Packers, I could never figure out for years why the cheeseheads were such eccentric, obsessive, compulsive, proud fans of their team. Until I learned that years and years ago, the team was started by a guy named Lambeau. And around 1912 or so, they were all meat packers. And that's where Green Bay, the Packers came in. That's where the title comes in. So we went bankrupt. But everybody loved the team and was so proud of it. They all got together and they go, what do we do? So they formed like a community corporation, and the people in the town bought shares. And so the people are the shareholders. To this day, the Green Bay Packers is the only nonprofit NFL team in America. And I know a couple of people in San Luis Obispo that, oh, yeah, I'm a shareholder of the Green Bay Packers. So, and what's really cute about it, so I'm going around the stadium with one of the heads, and I go, okay, well, how about all these, the food stands, you know, the hot dogs and whatnot, that's probably a profit center for you. And they go, no, we have nonprofit organizations run them to help them raise funds. It's really, really a precious story.
It's certainly one of a kind.
It is.
In NFL.
Nothing like it anywhere. But that's why the Cheeseheads are so damn proud and just passionate about their team.
Tom Wilmer on this broadcast. Now, you're going back to Wisconsin. Why are you going back?
To be with the Green Bay Packers and dig deeper.
Well, what do you want to know?
I don't know. That's why I'm going, to find out the rest of the secret. When I go on my trips, I don't want to know too much ahead of time. I don't do much research. I kind of want to let it, you know, expose itself as I dig in and meet people.
Share with us a little bit about how you're treated in these different states you visit.
Well, I mean, generally pretty good. I mean, somebody meets me at the airport and, you know, arrangements are already set up for a place to stay and whatnot. And there's somebody that interviews are set up so the person is waiting for you and whatnot. It makes it quite easy and seamless because that's part of the battle and the hassle. I mean, I have an incredible entree that I don't know how I would do it otherwise. For example, coming up to the 75th anniversary of Pearl Harbor, I wanted to interview the retired four-star admiral of the Pacific Fleet because he was ahead of the commemoration. And there he was waiting for me to talk with me. So things like that. I don't even know how I'd find the guy if I didn't have that entree.
You even have connections in Wisconsin. Who's this one? Stephanie
Klett. Scott Walker had a cabinet, and she was his cabinet secretary for tourism. She's a pretty incredible woman. She hosted a travel show in Wisconsin about Wisconsin for 20 years, so she knows every tiny little town in that state. And I got introduced to her, and we became friends. When I come up there, when it worked out, scheduling, she'd be waiting for me at the hotel or whatever, and we'd do a show about Wisconsin, and it was really fun.
So I would imagine that being in California, we don't have to spend that much effort on tourism because we have so much going for us.
Well, they still...
To like the Midwest.
They have a parallel organization. I think it's called Visit California. Yeah. And there's a lot of money invested in that, a lot of promotion. And whatnot. I think you have to keep working it wherever you are. But yeah, you're right. I mean, like, I've done stuff with Alcatraz. That's a National Park Service concessionaire. Alcatraz Cruises. It takes you out on the boat. And it's... I think 2015, it was the number one tourist destination. I forget what organization. TripAdvisor.
Alcatraz.
Alcatraz rated it the number one tourist destination in all North America. You know,
really?
Going on that Alcatraz cruises in the high season, you have to book your ticket as much as 3 months ahead of time. So you're right. You know, they don't have to work it, and yet they do.
Is it worth it?
Oh, yeah. Are you kidding?
I don't know. I have not.
Yeah,
been.
Well, you got to go. I've been there, gosh, 6-7 times. I'd go again.
How about Angel Island?
Yeah, most definitely. Yeah, they have.
See, that's where I'd like to go.
Yeah, that's really cool. And you can go to Angel Island two ways. You can go up in the north of San Francisco, Tiburon. They have a ferry boat that comes across, or you can take it from around the ferry terminal in San Francisco, come over to Angel Island.
Tom Woelmer is on this broadcast. He travels the world. He travels the country. We're catching up on some of his recent adventures. We will pick up on that as we continue. We got news, traffic, weather, and more of Hometown Radio. I'm Dave Congleton. Good to be with you this afternoon. This is the Dave Congleton Show, always your hometown radio talk show. Terry Bass will be here tomorrow to talk about the Central Coast Writers Conference that's kind of right around the corner. Also, the mayor of Arroyo Grande, Karen Ray Russom, talks about the financial challenges facing the city. We're also going to take a look at horse racing in California and try to figure out why so many horses are dying. I don't get that. It is the Dave Congleton Show, weekday afternoons from 3 to 7 on AM 920, FM 96.5. News Talk KVEC. We're back with travel writer extraordinaire Tom Woelmer, who has been to so many countries he can't even keep track. What's the website, Tom, to follow some of your adventures?
I'm so busy I rarely get time to update my website, but it's thomaswilmer.com, W-I-L-M-E-R.
30 years in the biz. New book in the making as we speak. All right. I know you want people to buy the book when it comes out, but you got to tell me about body surfing cows.
Oh, that was funny. This is a true story. I was on, you remember the red and white fleet in San Francisco? The big tour boats that go around the bay?
Yeah.
Well, I was on a special run, and they were going up the deep water ship canal from San Francisco to Sacramento. And so I'm in the wheelhouse with the skipper and the deckhand, and we're telling lies about working in Alaska. And the skipper says, look at this up ahead. Now, you keep your eyes out. There were about 10 giant cows that were in the shallows of the water eating the reeds and stuff. He said, unfortunately, the cows realize that we put out a 6-foot wake much too late. And at the last minute, they see it and they freak and they start running through the water, which is exactly what you would want to do to catch a wave if you were a body surfer.
Yeah.
And the cows do catch the waves unwittingly. and it was hilarious. They're going down the face, the waves, you know, with their hooves out, and we're tooting the horn and cheering them on. So, but the point of the story is that cows do actually body surf.
Let there not be any doubt.
I was there. I saw it.
See, that's the cool thing about your job. You have all these experiences. No 2 days are the same, right?
Oh, my God. Yeah. And you never know what's going to happen tomorrow. Yeah. There, one of the, another kind of humorous one was you asked about the Russian border.
Yeah.
So I was in Finland on the eastern edge on the Russian border. And you have the Finnish frontier guards, kind of like National Guard guys that patrol. And they had their base there, their little headquarters, kind of looked like a National Park Ranger station. And across the road from their little headquarters was a meadow. And in it was this, what do you call it, kind of a workout track where you had hurdles and little tunnels and all kinds of.
Like a little obstacle course.
Yeah. And so two of the journalists that I was with, we had been cooped up in a Land Rover all morning, we were buggy, and they decided to run the military's obstacle course without asking. So about five of the troops came out, and they're just staring incredulously at this couple that are running through the hurdles and through the tunnels and whatnot. They successfully navigated everyone, and you can see them doing the high five, you know, how bad they were. And this army guys are laughing their heads off. And so I said to my Finnish guide, I go, Yussi, why is the army laughing at them? And he goes, oh, these not for humans. These dog obstacle course. Anyway, that's a moment unplanned.
Well, but at least they did it.
Yeah, well, they
at least
did.
They completed
they
it.
They were so proud.
It would have been more embarrassing if they were like, ah, this is too tough for us.
Well, we couldn't figure out why the hurdles were only like 1.5 foot tall. You know? But they did it.
Now, you were in, I think it was in Tennessee. Where'd you meet Sergeant York's daughter?
Oh, yeah, Eastern Tennessee at Sergeant Alvin York's home, which they've restored and maintained exactly like it was, as if he walked out back.
Okay, so Sergeant York, a classic move of Gary Cooper, World War I hero.
And he was a pacifist.
He was a pacifist.
Didn't even want to go. Yeah.
Didn't want to go.
No.
And he went, and he became a hero.
Yeah, I mean, he took out, I think he had 132 Germans that he personally got to surrender, and he marched them in. Yeah, he was in. And he had been a hunter out in the poor area of Eastern Tennessee where he was, so he was a marksman, and he was an expert shot. And so he could just pick off the Germans in his sleep.
All right, so what was the assignment?
Well, the assignment was exploring Eastern Tennessee, and they said, would you like to go to Sergeant York's home? We have Betsy York, his daughter, waiting to meet you.
His daughter is still alive.
Yeah, 86 or something like that. Wow. And then his granddaughter, too, came to meet me, so I interviewed both of them.
So how do they remember Alvin York in Eastern Tennessee? I mean, do they have a little museum?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Okay. It was interesting. Alvin York was so poor and uneducated that he realized that education was a really important mission. So he started a school, and that school still exists today. And parts of the old school, they're right now restoring to a big kind of a World War One war memorial site and veteran site and honoring military. And that probably in a year or so will be done. You could Google Sergeant York in Eastern Tennessee. It's called Pall Mall, Tennessee is where it is.
And his daughter,
yeah, 86. Betsy, yeah. So, and, you know, they're all just so modest. It was really uncanny. He came back, and he was my dad. And what was really kind of eerie, they had a World War One reenactor, a guy with World War One military outfit that was with us. And you're in his creaky, modest farmhouse. He had this sense of timelessness being there with her in the home. Yeah, his books and paintings on the wall, everything was as he would have remembered it.
Did you learn anything particularly interesting about Alvin York?
I think just his passion, you know, and he was really cute. When he's coming back from Europe, he's on this troop transport, and he looks off the side of the ship when they're coming into New York, and there's like 5,000 people waiting, And he goes, wow, look at all the people that are waiting to greet us. And a couple of troops said, no, Alvin, they're waiting to greet you. So I think his modesty, incredible, uncanny modesty forever. And he had opportunities, the daughter said, to make as much as $1 million back at the end of World War One, doing sponsorships and whatnot. Everybody wanted him, and he turned them all down because he did not want to take advantage of his perception as being a hero.
Talking with Tom Wilmer, who travels the globe and travels the country. While you were back there, you also went to Knoxville, Tennessee.
Yeah, Knoxville was really fascinating because I knew so little about it. I did vaguely remember that it was the site of the 1982 World's Fair, which at the time was kind of an anomaly in that people at the time were going, Knoxville, you know, why there?
Yeah.
But they pulled it off and they did it. And to this day, there are some of the original stuff they had, the Sun Sphere Tower and whatnot.
And can you answer the question, Tom, why there? Why was there a World's Fair in Knoxville?
It had to do actually with energy and petroleum and whatnot. There were a lot of big players in the energy field there that were kind of the momentum behind that.
A lot of money.
Yeah, and it was interesting that to this day, there is that legacy outgrowth of the World's Fair that was there that helped kind of spur the momentum of development and whatnot.
What are you saying, Craig?
There was an episode of The Simpsons where they got onto the kids stowed away and they were going to go to this great adventure. They thought this great World's Fair, they had this idea of like mega Disneyland, and they get there and it was the closed remains of that World's Fair in Knoxville. Yeah. And they were, and all that was left was the Sun Sphere.
Yeah. Well, there is also a very beautiful outdoor music pavilion with a kind of a tent top on it, but that's about it.
What'd you think of Knoxville?
I loved it. It was really cute. I went to a blues festival there, and from my hotel, I walked probably 15 blocks across town and back at 10 at night, 10:30. I'm walking downtown through town, and all the restaurants are alive and buzzing with people out on the little sidewalk, alfresco dining and whatnot. And people were so friendly there. There was a couple, as I was going to the blues festival, I said, how do I get there? They go, oh, we'll walk with you. We'll show you. You know, so it was really typical. One of the interesting things about Knoxville, they have something that's called the urban wilderness. And they have 1,000 acres dedicated as wilderness trails and whatnot, right in the heart of town. So it was really uncanny to be on this wilderness hike through the jungles and trees and whatnot, and yet you had to remind yourself you're in the middle of the city, and they are really proud of that. And they're biking trails through there, hiking trails, and kayaking because they have lakes up there. Yeah.
We're chatting with Tom Wilmer about his recent adventures. We'll come back for a final segment. I'm Dave Congleton. You're listening to AM 920 FM 96.5 News Talk KVEC. Top of the hour, it's ABC Radio News. Then Mike Brown joins us from Colab. We're in our final segment with travel writer extraordinaire Tom Wilmer, celebrating 30 years on air with public radio. And even better news is that sometime in the not-too-distant future, he's got a new book coming out. Two things I want to make sure we get to.
Sure.
White celery versus green celery.
Oh, that's a great story. I interviewed Andy D'Arrigo up in Salinas.
Okay.
And if anybody might be familiar with the label on the end of the boxes, Andy Boy, that's Andy Boy. And that label's been around since the 20s. All right. The D'Arrigo family found this, well, let me back up. In America, all celery was white until they went to France and they found this Pascal variety of celery that was green. And it was so superior, they went, man, this is it. So they brought it back, planted it en masse, and nobody would buy it.
What year?
I think the late 20s.
So there used to be white celery.
Yeah, that's all you could get. So in the marketplace, these people saw this green celery, and they wouldn't touch it. So the D'Arrigos had to hire these little worker ladies in Salinas to sew, you know, 10 million newspaper sleeves to put over every stalk of celery in the field to keep it white so that people would buy it. eventually people caught on. And today, like you and me, we didn't even know that there was white celery.
I've never heard of white celery.
The other thing they...
Can you still get white celery?
I don't know. That's a good question.
Okay, continue.
The other thing they introduced to American consumers was broccoli. When they came to America from Sicily in about 1911, and they settled in the Boston area. And so the Sicilian community on the East Coast, they knew broccoli, and everybody would plant it in their backyards. But it was not a commercially available crop. And so the D'Arrigo family loved it and started planting it and growing it commercially. So they're the ones that introduced broccoli to America. That's a great story.
I got to hang out with you more often.
Yeah, well, come with me.
Same family.
Yeah, so, and Andy boy, Andy, it must be 90 or 91, as far as I know. He's still active and still comes into the office, and is still a family-held business, which is quite huge, but family-run.
So they're responsible for both green celery and broccoli.
Yep. Yeah.
And did broccoli have an easy time coming in?
They didn't tell me about any barriers. It sounds like a pretty smooth introduction.
I'm just wondering if people embrace broccoli or not.
Well, eventually.
Yeah. I love broccoli. Yeah. All right. Now, the other one I'll make sure we get to. Who is the Hunter Liggett in Fort Hunter Liggett? Are these two guys, one guy?
Okay. So it turns out I, like everybody, was confused by the name Hunter Liggett. Even many people in the military think that it's like a hyphenated something to people, or that Liggett was a hunter. Yeah. It turns out he was like number two top general in World War I, General Hunter Liggett. And he is revered to this day as a game changer in military tactics. He introduced what's called combined arms techniques. Before, artillery would do their thing and infantry would do theirs, and he combined them so they worked together in concert, which was a huge game changer. And like I said, to this day, Hunter Liggett Army Base is the number one largest Army Reserve training base in America. They have 165,000 acres, and they...
That's huge, yeah.
Yeah, and they do to this day in their training the Hunter Liggett model.
Yeah. And what was his connection to California?
I don't think there was any.
We need to name this after somebody, Hunter Liggett.
Yeah, and at the time, the Hunter Liggett opened in 1941, and they took over William Randolph Hearst's ranch headquarters. His ranch headquarters actually was built by, what's her name that built Hearst Castle?
Julia Morgan.
Julia Morgan. She built and designed it. And amazingly, the Army, one reason or another, never bastardized it or degraded it. They revered it, and they maintain it, and they have a historic mission to keep it in its kind of in situ way it was. An interesting unadvertised thing is that on most military bases, as a veteran or active duty, you can come and stay on the base. They have cool housing or different things you can get away. You do not have to be active military, retired, or a veteran to come and stay at William Randolph's hacienda.
Oh, yeah, the upstairs.
Yeah, well, there's upstairs, grand suites, a couple of them, but downstairs are these very efficient, small little rooms where the cowboys would stay. So you can do either. And it's very reasonable. For the big suite upstairs, it's $160 a night.
Well, the reason I'm asking about that, is that the same place over the bar?
Yes.
Okay.
Yep.
Yeah, I've had friends do that, Tom, and the only problem is that you got to make sure it's not the weekend that they have National Guard duty. Because then they're in the bar all night.
Right.
And you're not going to get any sleep.
Yeah.
No, I know some people have done that.
Yeah. And the other thing that's really cool across the street is Mission San Antonio.
Beautiful mission.
That's the third oldest mission in the state of California.
Isn't it called the Lost Mission?
I think so.
Yeah. Because it's out of the way. Nobody goes there.
And I think, as I remember, it was the first mission to have red tile roofs. But yeah, it's a if you're into the mission trail, that's like a mandatory stop because it's so unknown.
So you can hit the hacienda, you can hit the mission, and then you can go up and over Nacimiento Ferguson Road, come down Highway 1.
Yeah, and that's a great little journey, and then finish it going down Big Sur.
Craig is reporting that white celery goes all the way back to China.
Wow. Maybe they can reintroduce.
Does that surprise you?
No, not at all. Maybe they can reintroduce it, because you and I would like to know what it tastes like.
Yeah. Who says you don't learn anything listening to the show? I never knew there was such a thing as white celery. All right, so you're going to go to Wisconsin. What's after that? What's the rest of your look like for your travel-wise?
Then I go back to Wisconsin again early August to Beloit, Wisconsin.
I've been there.
You have?
Beloit College. It's right there on the Illinois-Wisconsin border.
Yeah, I never have. And that, again, that's why I'm going, because I'm just so curious about America. And as you know, for years and years, I traveled around the world and never traveled around America. And about 5 years ago, I think it was, I thought, you know, I'm going to focus more exploring America. And it's so amazing. I told you about Kingsport, Tennessee, this Rustport town that was dying. You find little towns that are like anomalies that are, Kingsport is now thriving. And part of the reason why, when it died as a rust manufacturing town, they thought, how do we save ourselves? How do we reinvent ourselves? And they got together with all the business people and community leaders, and they realized that their future depended upon educating their young people and keeping them there. And they came up with an incredible program where every kid that grows up there gets their first 2 years of college technical school education for free if they maintain a certain grade level. The state of Tennessee loved it so much that they took that same model, and it's now available across the state, and it's called Tennessee Promise. But there's more to the secret of what they did. They met with the business people and the corporate people, and they go, what do you need in a trained, skilled employee entry level coming in? So they gave them their list, and that's exactly how they teach in the tech schools, so that when the kids come out, they are truly trained and ready to go. It's such a great program that Harvard University Business School gave them a major nationwide award for.
It's called the Tennessee Promise.
Well, that's the state model,
right?
But I don't know what the Kingsport part is.
Hmm.
And then I was going to tell you about the true story of the derivation of the Long Island iced tea.
It's moonshine, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, that everybody thought, as I did, that Long Island iced tea was obviously from New York.
Yeah.
So I get there, and they introduce me to the granddaughter of this moonshiner who grew up and made moonshine on Long Island, which is a little island in the river in Kingsport, Tennessee. And it became a legend around Tennessee. And so then Long Island, New York, they were claiming it. And so Long Island or Kingsport said, no, we invented it, and they even found an old Betty Crocker cookbook with the recipe for it. And so now they have this annual battle of the bartenders between the two regions to determine who makes the best Long Island iced tea.
I've had Long Island iced tea once.
Yeah, well, that'll
flatten. It was enough.
That'll flatten you.
Yeah.
I think it's like five different liquors. In
yes. Packs a wallop. Have you been to all 50 states?
Nope. Uh-uh.
How many do you have yet to go?
Again, I don't keep track. I don't have a list.
But you got to keep. I mean, I think like two. I got three to go.
What do you got?
I got Maine, Rhode Island, and South Carolina. By the end of the year, we'll be down to South Carolina.
Well, you beat me. I don't remember the ones I haven't been to, but those are some I have not. What happens is, like, I fell in love with Wisconsin, and for years, I loved Nebraska, of all places.
Yeah.
I have been to more of Nebraska than 98% of Nebraskans. Been to every single area of the state.
Johnny Carson's from there.
Yeah.
Norfolk.
Yeah, I went there.
I spent a weekend at Norfolk Community College.
Okay. What was the original name of the town?
I knew at one point.
It was like the North Fork, and then like the post office got it wrong and spelled it wrong. And so, yeah.
Always good to have you on the show, Tom. Thanks for your time.
You too, Dave.
Another 30 years.
Yeah.
Off we go. News, traffic, weather. Get ready. Mike Brown is in the house. You're listening to the Dave Congleton Show.